Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk a bit about the country we love and some of the perils that it is facing at the moment here at home, and from internal challenges and threats, and why. With whom? With George Raceley, as I'm fond of saying, our duty genius on this program, Mensa Society member, as well as one very experienced political operative, some 300 campaigns to his credit, including at the presidential level, service as an aide to the Vice President of the United States, and on Capitol Hill and in other capacities. Today, he is the editor-in-chief of a terrific newsletter that our friend Richard Viguerie publishes, entitled Conservative HQ. It's great to have you with us, George. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. I'll try and live up to that buildup.
No small challenge, but you will, I know for sure. So, George, as we speak, the President of the United States and the Speaker of the House, and I assume others on Capitol Hill, are supposed to reconvene to talk further about the impending default on the national debt, if they don't come to some sort of understanding that would enable the debt ceiling to be raised. By the time this program airs, that latest conversation will be behind us, but probably we will still be in the midst of ferment and negotiations over these subjects. What is going on here, George? The president seems to think very little of the Republican position. The Republicans are respectfully but adamantly insistent on some measure of budget discipline. How do you see things, and where do you think it goes from here?
Well, this is the latest round in what I call a chaos solution, chaos cycle, in which there is a Democrat-created crisis, which demands only a Democrat-approved solution. So rather than engaging in negotiations that would actually solve the debt problem, because the debt problem is created by our spending problem, and so there needs to be at some point a plan to harmonize tax collections, which I might add are at record levels, with spending. And that's never going to happen as long as Republicans cede the high ground in these matters to the Democrats. And so consequently, we have this so-called threatened crisis of a federal default, which is complete nonsense. The government is taking in plenty of money. It can pay its bills with the money it's taking in. It may not pay them on time, but it certainly can pay Social Security, pay Medicare, pay the interest to our T-bill holders, etc. The ultimate solution is to reduce spending so that it matches tax collections. And Democrats are never going to do that. They much prefer to have the cycle of spend more than we collect, borrow the difference from Red China, rinse and repeat. And unfortunately, I don't see the Republicans as taking this opportunity to have sort of a revolutionary moment, if you will, and force Democrats to take ownership of the problem and use the resulting chaos or crisis to advance their own quest for power. Instead, they're going to help Democrats repeat the cycle.
To hear the Democrats speak about it, the Republicans are engaged in a revolutionary moment, even by simply saying, look, we have to keep expenditures to last year's levels. But as you say, George, it doesn't begin to approach what's needed in terms of correcting the cycle, the dynamic that we're in. Just very quickly, is your expectation that this will go right down to the wire of June 1st, as we're told?
Yeah, I expect that it will. And it will go down to the wire because Joe Biden and the Democrats see no reason to give the Republicans any credit for anything remotely resembling a fix. And unfortunately, you know, the media, largely dominated by the left, will assist them in sticking Republicans with the blame for any resultant chaos.
We've seen this movie before, and it sounds like we're going to see it again. George, let me pivot to another issue. We've had in the past few days the much-awaited John Durham report, the special prosecutor's report looking into what actually was done to Donald Trump in the run-up to, well, the first election, 2016, and thereafter. You've actually read the thing, which is an extraordinary distinction. I don't know if anybody else who has. Tell us what you found and what, why so little has come of it.
Well, you've outed me as having a very boring life, Frank. But, well, the I think the most important feature of the Durham report is what's not in it, which is any indictment of the malefactors and any subpoenas, interrogation under oath of all the principal players. And so Durham collected all these facts. He had them before him. He could have subpoenaed Comey, McCabe, Stroke, all the other players in Crossfire Hurricane, and he didn't. And I continue to be astonished that he didn't do that, because that was such an elementary step.
Yeah, but let me ask, I mean, apart from the question of, you know, getting them in under oath, the findings, as I understand them, are pretty damning of these individuals, and still there were no indictments brought against them.
They're very damning. They certainly have created the predicate for a subpoena and interrogation and potentially an indictment. And I, you know, it just astonishes me that Durham didn't do that. So, you know, we're left with the conclusion that this is sort of a controlled opposition act in which, you know, the facts were laid bare for the you know, entertainment of future historians, but, you know, there'll no doubt be some PhD theses written about, you know, what happened and didn't happen in this. But the bottom line is that the bad guys were not and will not be punished.
Yeah. George, is there any possibility that the Congress would be able to do something with this evidence? I mean, obviously it still falls to the Justice Department to prosecute, but
yeah,
is that an option?
Well, it, you know, that would be kind of an interesting question to consider. Clearly Congress could call in any of those guys, subpoena them, put them under oath, interrogate them about the facts that the Durham report revealed. If they lied, they could then be referred to
under perjury.
Department of Justice.
We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with George Raisley right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On May 17th, the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party threat held what may prove to be the most important congressional hearing in a generation. It featured testimony from three men who have made history. Each addressed the unrestricted warfare the CCP has long waged against us. Trump advisor Robert Lighthizer described Beijing's devastating economic and unfair trade practices. Former Google CEO Eric Schmidt warned of Chinese efforts to steal and dominate militarily relevant technologies. But it was my friend Roger Robinson who helped Ronald Reagan take down the Soviet Union, the last totalitarian regime that sought our destruction, who really broke the code. He revealed the invaluable help the Chinese communists have gotten from Wall Street and how, if we stop underwriting our mortal enemy, we just may succeed in defeating the CCP too, without fighting. Let's roll. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. George Raceley is in the house, the editor-in-chief of Conservative HQ, a marvelous newsletter by one of the great political savants of our time, Richard Viguerie. Another of the great political savants of our time is, of course, George Raceley as well. George, we were talking about the possibility that Congress could pick up the baton in a fashion that has been kind of handed off, or at least thrown at them by John Durham. In the sense, insofar as they might, you know, call in people who he has essentially found complicit in illegal activity, and put them under oath and get sworn testimony and so on from them. The other possibility, or maybe part of such a process, is, as I understand it, you can in fact impeach people who have held office to ensure that they will never be allowed to hold office again. And that is a two-step process. Of course, the House does the indicting through the impeachment process, and then conviction awaits the Senate. But is that a possibility here? And should it be something that we encourage, whether it's the testimony alone or whether it's to that end?
The Congress can take the whole impeachment of a former official is an interesting constitutional question. I think people who are a lot smarter than I am about constitutional law have suggested that it is possible. Certainly calling these guys in, getting them under oath, questioning them, interrogating them about the findings of the Durham report would be in order, would be a perfectly appropriate and constitutional congressional action for House committees. I don't think that that would in any way run afoul of the Constitution's prohibition on bills of attainder. And if the subject lied, or if the facts were revealed to warrant impeachment, they could certainly be impeached.
Let me turn to a new topic with you. You've written at Conservative HQ recently about the woke agenda and what it is doing to the U.S. border. I personally prefer the term Marxist agenda rather than woke, but whatever you call it, it's clearly had devastating effects on our border. George, there does not seem to be an end in sight. Title 42 is now history, and there's a large and growing number of people, it seems, now prepared to make their way here, convinced that they will not be stopped or otherwise hindered. Yeah. The Biden team professes that, they've adjusted their asylum policies, and it's going to be much harder to get in. What's your take on all of that and the prospects for it getting worse?
Well, the prospect for it getting worse is almost 100%, I would say. Biden's so-called adjustment of the asylum procedures is essentially to change the names on forms. And, you know, you fill out a different form now and they let you loose inside the United inside the United States. And in fact, they give you a free ticket to, you know, wherever you want to go. They're literally stacking them up on mattresses in Chicago police stations. And the problem with this is, in addition just to the vast numbers of new competitors for American jobs, the new numbers of drug dealers and drug mules that are being let in, there are also operatives for our mortal enemies in the Middle East and particularly in Red China. And so we're, in essence, facilitating the infiltration of our country by the foreign military.
Right. You know, I we're going to talk about this, I think, in our webinar conducted by the Committee on the Present Danger of China this week, George. And it stems from conversations that we've been having as we've learned more and more about, as you say, not only 100 plus Chinese nationals, all of whom seem to have several characteristics in common. They're all fighting age males. They all seem to be in pretty good shape, especially given that they've made an arduous journey up through and along from the Darien Gap in Panama. They all seem to be wearing the same kit, you know, backpacks and canteens and so on. And according to Michael Yan, a seasoned war correspondent, they all seem to be traveling in groups, or you might say units. And the prospect that there are now thousands and thousands of folks that made that transition from one side of the border to, or what used to be the border to ours, does speak directly to your point that this is essentially staffing up, if you will, the insurgency that almost certainly would come in tandem with whatever the Chinese decide to do to us from outside the country.
Yeah.
Is that how you see it? And how bad could that possibly go?
Well, that is exactly how I see it, Frank. And when you look at the numbers, we've just in less than a year let in six battalions of Chinese special forces, red Chinese special forces operators. The trek from through the Darien Gap to the border is, you know, that's a weekend ruck for these guys. They are highly motivated, ideological, very well trained. The Red Chinese have been working on building up their special forces ever since really the first Gulf War. And they've got, you know, 30 plus years of honing these guys and their skills to the kind of level that they need to do some serious damage internally in the United States when Red China makes its next move, whether it's on Taiwan or whether it's on the continental United States.
Or both.
Yeah.
George, those are stunning statistics, and I've heard people sort of brooding them about. Are you confident that those numbers are roughly correct and that that they are in fact special forces units? I mean, it's bad enough if they're regular army units for that matter. Whatever they are is a problem, especially in those kinds of numbers.
They have all the characteristics of Red Chinese special forces operators. Obviously, if we stop them and interrogate them, they say, "Oh no, I'm coming to work in my uncle's restaurant in New York." You know.
But, for a better life.
Yeah, for a better life. But they certainly don't look like a bunch of poor peasants from the Chinese countryside. They have all of the characteristics of highly trained, ideologically motivated operators.
People sent here for a mission.
Yeah.
We've had on various webinars in the past people like Rick Fisher, who talk about, you know, them being assigned the task of doing sabotage and assassinations and other kinds of subversion. We'll get into this in much more detail in our program this week. And folks, if you haven't already subscribed to these webinars, I strongly encourage you to do so at presentdangerchina.org. The days we conduct them sometimes vary. This one will probably be Friday, I think, of this week. But they're fascinating. And of course, as we'll talk about elsewhere in the show, they're the feedstock for this book, The Indictment, which George Raisler gave a fabulous review to. And I'm very grateful to you for doing that, George, at your superb outlet, Conservative HQ. We appreciate our visits with you, my friend, each time, and all that you do between times. And we know
Thank you. Keep
up both. And we're grateful for that. And we'll talk with you again in the days to come. In the meantime, stay well. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our favorite guests. His name is Chuck DeVore, a man of many parts, a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, now retired. Man who has served as a state assemblyman in his formerly native state of California and is now a senior member of an important institution in Austin, Texas, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, where he serves as its chief of national priorities, national initiatives, I think it's called. And one of his initiatives is Securing America, a project we share, and we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him. Colonel, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Great to be with you, Frank.
You had a powerful piece in The Federalist the other day, and I wanted to just visit with you about it at a time when ground truth, as it's sometimes called, seems to be shifting about Ukraine. We've had President Biden shifting, for example, on whether he would oppose or support the provision of advanced fighter aircraft, F-16s to be precise, to the Ukrainians, and in particular in connection therewith training those pilots in the United States. Seems that that was objectionable before, but is now agreeable and will be going forward, I guess. More broadly, would you give us a sense of the state of the war? You've written powerfully about some of the war crimes that the Russians are apparently guilty of in its pursuit. And, you know, where you think things are headed.
Right. Thank you, Frank. I think it's very important as we look at U.S. national security interests that we do so with a steely eye and a firm resolve to not allow, so far as we can, emotions or arguments around morality per se to be driving the equation, right? The U.S. does not have the resources, it doesn't have the willpower, nor is it in our interests to necessarily get involved, whether with troops or with equipment, everywhere in the world that we see injustice. Of course, that would be most parts of the world, even here at home, of course. That said, it doesn't mean that we turn a blind eye to what's going on in different parts of the world. And what's happening in Ukraine, I think, is very interesting from the standpoint of history. If you look at the Ukrainian people and their fraught relationship with Russia, you see that over the years, for example, in the wake of World War I, there was unrest, some of it, of course, being egged on by the German Empire in the latter stages of World War I. Ukraine was independent for a short period of time. There was a crackdown under the Soviet Union. An enormous number of Ukrainians died in what they call the Holodomor. Many were sent out into exile to Siberia. I've even seen the logistical hub of the Gulag Archipelago in Magadan at the north end of the Sea of Okhotsk, and was surprised when I was in Kamchatka some 30 years ago to learn that 40% of the people there were of Ukrainian descent, many of them the sons and daughters and grandchildren of Ukrainians that were exiled there. So there's this long history of Ukraine giving the Russians a hard time, if you will, and the Russians cracking down by either committing genocide or putting them into exile. And we see that again today, where you see millions of Ukrainians who have been displaced out of Ukraine, moved into Russia, including more than 500,000 children who are now being forced to learn nothing but Russian. They're being re-educated to be good Russian citizens. Ironically, Frank, the number of people who have either died or fled Russia, or the number of children who haven't been born as the result of Putin's war against Ukraine, roughly equals the approximately 555,000 children from Ukraine that have been taken to Russia. So this is pretty sinister when you think about it. It's also important to understand that in warfare, there is a legitimate function for determining among the civilian population who's going to resist the occupation and who's going to be quiescent. Now, the Russians call this filtration. There's nothing wrong with that per se. It's part of trying to pacify a occupied area. Now, in this case, of course, it's an illegal invasion, and you could argue that Russia has done far more than simply filtrate civilians that are going to be a problem. There's reports, widespread reports of torture, of telling civilians that, hey, if you don't come with us, you know, the Ukrainians are going to attack. And if you don't come with us, they're going to assume that you were a traitor and they're going to torture you. So you better come with us. So there's just to wrap up, Frank, there is a concerted effort by Russia under Putin to conduct a very unique and what I would say unsettling or evil brand of war targeted specifically at the Ukrainian civilian population that goes far beyond legitimate military measures to try to prevent or to tamp down partisan activity behind your lines.
Right. And that statistic about 500,000 children being removed is particularly gripping, as you've indicated, Chuck. And I think that the extent to which that constitutes, as you've suggested, I guess, as well, that it's kind of a depopulation of Ukraine, as well as changing the character of the populace if they ever do get to go home.
Right.
Is very, very grim. But so is the conduct of the war itself. And can you just give us an update, as you see it, of the nature of the conflict at the moment? Is right. Russia poised to decisively defeat Ukraine, or is it just muddling through? Is there likely to be a Ukrainian counteroffensive anytime
yes.
soon?
I think you're about ready to see a pretty significant shift in battlefield fortunes in favor of the Ukrainians. It's important to understand that when people simply look at the numbers and they say, well, you know, Russia has three times the population and you know, 5 to 10 times the economy of Ukraine, it's inevitable. Well, nothing's inevitable. I'm reminded of General Eisenhower's words, right? It's not the size of the dog in the fight that matters. Rather, it's the size of the fight in the dog. And so what you're seeing now is Russia is a very vast place, right? Russia has several constituent republics. They need a significant amount of the people that they draft to go into border guards and police and other internal security. And it doesn't leave a lot for the war against Ukraine. And the other thing we're seeing, Frank, is that the Soviet-era equipment, to the extent that it was any good at all, was not well maintained. It was significantly hampered by the fact that a lot of the storage facilities were not up to snuff. A lot of the equipment just simply rotted, or much of it was sold on the black market. And so what you're going to see very soon is you're going to see modest numbers of Western equipment that have been provided to Ukraine that was specifically designed to fight the Soviet-era equipment. And you're going to find it being unleashed against the Russians in a way that I think will be not too dissimilar to what you saw in the original Gulf War and the follow-on war against Iraq, where you had Iraqis using Russian or Soviet-era equipment against Western equipment. So I would expect to see some pretty significant and dramatic shifts on the battlefield with large numbers of Russians surrendering or being surrounded, being pushed out. And it's going to be pretty chaotic. That's the other thing, is that both sides are going to do everything they can to conduct information warfare. So it will be, by design, difficult to follow from afar.
Yeah. But when you say a shift in fortunes, you're anticipating that the infusion of that limited amount of Western equipment, including, I guess, though the timing is a little unclear at the moment, of fighter aircraft,
right,
like the F-16, that will translate, given the problems the Russians are having, into a decisive advantage. And does that mean that we'll see territory liberated that has been captured by the Russians, and that is part of the reason for continuing the fight on the part of the Ukrainians is liberating?
Yeah, I think you're going to see considerable amounts of territory liberated. I think the important thing, though, to understand is that any initial objective in the fight has got to be not based on territory, but based on the warfighting capacity of your enemy. So, in other words, if you take land and lose a lot of soldiers, then the other side is eventually going to be able to retake that land. And you're seeing this with the Russian push at Bakhmut, where the Ukrainians essentially turned it into a modern-day Verdun or Stalingrad and just ground down enormous amounts of Russian manpower and equipment. And at the end of the day, if the Russians end up withdrawing from this destroyed husk of a city, what did it profit them to take it in the first place? And similarly, I think that the Ukrainian initial objectives are not going to be per se on recapturing land, but on surrounding and destroying Russian military formations.
There's a lot of talk, as you know, about just sort of effecting some kind of peace. Donald Trump says he could do it in a day. Others are saying it may take a little longer, but they are confident that they can do it, presumably by simply declaring some sort of hold in place as a
right.
ceasefire, and then maybe as the basis for a more durable suspension of hostilities, at least. How do you see that, Chuck, in less than 40 seconds?
Yeah, I think it's a lot more complicated than that. I certainly am sympathetic towards the desires to end what has been the most bloody conflict of Europe and anyone's recent lifetime. The challenge is that you could have peace if Russia just leaves tomorrow. The second thing, though, is that we have to avoid a frozen conflict. We've had that in Donbass since 2014.
Which can always be defrosted and started up again. That's the heart of the problem, isn't it? Chuck DeVore, I hate to cut you off. We'll have to have you back for a longer conversation about all of this. We look forward to it. In the meantime, thank you, sir, for your service. God bless you. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On May 17th, the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party threat held what may prove to be the most important congressional hearing in a generation. It featured testimony from three men who have made history.
each address the unrestricted warfare the CCP has long waged against us. Trump advisor Robert Lighthizer described Beijing's devastating economic and unfair trade practices. Former Google CEO Eric Schmidt warned of Chinese efforts to steal and dominate militarily relevant technologies. But it was my friend Roger Robinson who helped Ronald Reagan take down the Soviet Union, the last totalitarian regime that sought our destruction, who really broke the code. He revealed the invaluable help the Chinese communists have gotten from Wall Street and how, if we stop underwriting our mortal enemy, we just may succeed in defeating the CCP too, without fighting. Let's roll. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and as is often the case, well, almost always the case, in fact, about this time, we had a chance to visit with Bill Walton, a recovering master of the universe from Wall Street, who now runs television podcast program titled The Bill Walton Show. In his spare time, he is also very active in philanthropic activities as well as conservative movement programs, including with our shared interest in the Council on National Policy, Council for National Policy, I should call it. Bill Walton, it's good to have you with us, as always. Welcome back, sir.
Frank, great to see you.
Drawing on your experience in Wall Street, running Allied Capital, a $6 billion venture up there for a time, I wanted to draw you out, as we often do, on some developments that seem to be further eroding the advisability of China investments for Americans, whether they're pension funds or mutual funds or index funds or any other investment vehicle for that matter, despite the continuing determination of your former colleagues on Wall Street to make such investments. Walk us through some of the developments, Bill, that are making China, as you've said here, increasingly uninvestable for foreigners.
Well, China's been the honeypot for Wall Street for the last decade or more. It's a $60 trillion, potentially a $60 trillion market for them to manage assets. And Wall Street has made a fortune underwriting Chinese companies going public in the United States. And then many, including you and Roger Robinson, have alerted us all to the fact that these Chinese companies going public in the U.S. happen to be controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. And what makes matter worse as an investor is that they're giving us unaudited financial statements. So we have the Chinese Communist Party taking U.S. investor dollars and saying, well, you can trust us, of course. And then we've cracked down on that. And the PCAOB, which is the entity which oversees the accounting firms and accounting audits in America, has now been charged with overseeing audits in China. And surprise, surprise, the first results of those of that audit is that they found four firms. The big four accounting firms are all in China with big operations there. And they found faults with every single audit of the companies that they looked into, including and they focused particularly on technology companies and international security oriented companies. And there's some simple things that they didn't have in those audits. They failed to understand the IT systems. They couldn't check the revenue correctly, and they had incomplete documentation.
And what could possibly go wrong, Bill?
As you and I, what could possibly go wrong? And as you know, as somebody who's worked his way through business school teaching undergraduates accounting, that offends my sensibility to not have incomplete
documentation. Yeah,
they don't know the revenues.
Let me just ask you. You mentioned Roger Robinson, and I was very pleased to see that the China Select Committee had him featured as one of its witnesses on the 17th of May. I think a really important hearing, sort of laying bare the sort of economic and financial warfare the Chinese Communist Party has been waging against us. But I wanted to just say on this PCAOB thing, that Public Company Accounting Oversight Board is the unwieldy name that goes behind that acronym. What were they thinking when they decided that instead of having, you know, formal due diligence backed accounting here in this country, which every other company, as I understand it, on Wall Street has to be subjected to, that instead, well, I guess to this point, they've not had any accounting really at all for those Chinese companies, thanks to Joe Biden. But they were trying to come up with this workaround to do it in China, and it was assuredly going to come out this way, was it not?
Well, we knew it would. I mean, this was a negotiated deal with the Chinese Communist Party, and the Chinese Communist Party does not want to let us know what the insides of these companies look like financially.
They call them state secrets, Bill.
Well, everything in China is a state secret. As we know, the Espionage Act and the updated one is even more onerous. They used to talk about national security interest, and now they talk about national interest only, which means everything. So every single company and every single individual in China is subjected to this rule. And what China's doing, you mentioned due diligence, is they've begun a big crackdown in the last 6 to 12 months on due diligence firms operating in China. Now, as an investor, just to give a little tutorial, you don't go into an investment, at least a smart investor doesn't, unless you've done extensive work on the market, the companies, the technology, the pricing, the, you know, the suppliers, everything, and also the political risks. And in China, there are dozens of firms that provide this information to foreign investors, foreign to China, and the Chinese are shutting that down. And they just shut down CapVision, accusing CapVision of releasing state secrets. And, you know, to give you some feel for these companies, CapVision employed or had independent contractors, roughly 250,000 worldwide. They're headquartered in Shanghai and New York, I think. And these are accountants, these are industry experts, these are CEOs, these are people who've got industry experience. And whenever you go into something, you want to find out from them what's really happening. That's all being shut down, and including their database, which I misspoke a couple of weeks ago. It's called Wind Information. And investors used to have access to that, which had all the records of Chinese companies in it. We're no longer allowed to see it.
Which so, further raises questions about the advisability of doing business with any of these guys, which goes to your point about this becoming and, you know, totally uninvestable enterprise in China. And yet, as we've talked about, Bill, in recent weeks, Ray Dalio and others are continuing to assert that even in the face of prospective war, shooting war with China, according to Ray, his clients ought to continue to do business with the Chinese Communist Party. It's insane, irresponsible, and I believe betraying our country. Bill, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we will visit a little bit further on this and then talk a little bit about energy insecurity, a product of the Biden administration, right after this. Welcome back. Bill Walton is in the house, as he is about this time most weeks, very grateful for his participation. He is the host and driving force behind a marvelous podcast program, which I personally am going to be appearing in the days to come. It's entitled The Bill Walton Show. We're going to be talking about our book. Did I mention it today? I think not. The Indictment. We need to talk about it at great length with Bill and you, and we're delighted to be able to do so. But Bill, just on this question of the inadvisability of our putting more money in China, we've discussed this before, and I just want to confirm that it's still your view that if, in fact, we wind up in a shooting war with the Chinese communists, that it is even more unlikely than otherwise that investors with large amounts plunked down in China. And you mentioned that these are companies that work for the Chinese Communist Party. Of course, they all do, but there are some that we're seeing people invest in that are sanctioned. You're not allowed to buy their products in this country because of human rights abuses or because they work for the Chinese People's Liberation Army or both. And yet you can continue to invest in them. Those investments, I think, are all gone, are they not, in the event of a shooting war?
Well, as I say virtually every week, the amount of investment dollars you ought to have in China just as an individual investor is zero. But you've got to be careful about that, because if you're in mutual funds that are internationally oriented funds, the big companies have not really purged those funds of China, exposure to China. And so you've got
not purged. They continue to expand the presence, it seems to me.
Well,
A shares and all the rest of it.
Well, they'd like to. But Frank, you know, the Wall Street's putting a public face on this, that we're all in on China because they've got relationships they have to maintain with all the top party officials there. And they
lucrative relationships
they have. But privately, they're beginning to think about pulling back. I mean, even Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have cut their projections about doing business in China, and the fees they've gotten from China because the equity underwriting business is virtually gone, has dried up. And so even Goldman and Merrill and Morgan are seeing China's less investable than they did a year ago. So stay tuned.
But they better get with it right quick, because
but let me get at the U.S. investors in China. The thing we talk about the brand name Wall Street firms, but there's also the huge venture capital industry. And when you look at how these investors act, it's follow the money. And what's happening is there's sanctions on some companies operating in China, Chinese companies. And investors now are viewing them more favorably rather than less, because they think they've got the protection of the Chinese Communist Party. So when you think you're going in unprotected with something that the party's likely to take out, if you invest in a company they've already taken control of, you're considered more secure. So that's how cynical the investment process works. And I think for those of us watching this, we also need to be watching the private equity industry and venture capital to see where their funds are going and why.
More secure in the sense that as long as the Chinese Communist Party wants to do business with you, you've got business to do. But if they don't, and look at these due diligence firms, they were all brought in there for the purpose of working with the Chinese Communist Party, needless to say.
Cap, you know, I mentioned in the last segment that one of the due diligence firms making $35 or $40 million every quarter, and now that's all been shut down at zero. So buyer beware.
Buyer beware indeed. Speaking of buyers, the Biden administration promised us when it began raiding the Strategic Petroleum Reserves as part of its effort to bring down gasoline prices in the run-up to the 2022 election, that it would replenish them, make up every bit of it. We've heard from them now for some time that they're actually doing that. And there's been a recent announcement that they're, no kidding, really, they are doing that. But Bill, as I understand it, they have not bought anything up to this point. And whether they're going to buy 3 million barrels or not remains to be seen. But Tell us about whether that would constitute much of a difference, even if they finally get around to doing it.
Well, we've got an election rolling around, Frank, and the Biden administration is attempting to put lipstick on the pig. Jennifer Granholm recently announced to great fanfare that they were going to purchase...
She's the Secretary of Energy, of course.
Secretary of Energy, who doesn't believe we should be in the hydrocarbon industry at all. She announced to great fanfare they're going to buy 3 million barrels to replenish the reserve. Well, let's consider that in the context. And by the way, they haven't done it, but they say they're going to do it. They depleted it by 185 to 190 million barrels. So what she's suggesting is literally a drop in the bucket. And the reserve before they began drawing it down was close to, I think, probably 600 million barrels. So we're talking about an infinitesimal amount. And the odds of them doing it much more than that, I think, are better than your chance of getting your money back from investing in China.
But not much.
Not much. Not much better.
Yeah. And the point, Bill, is that the cost to the taxpayer of purchasing oil today, again, thanks to Biden's energy policies and frankly, thanks to what we describe in the indictment, is the energy warfare that the CCP and its friends here have engaged in, is going to be vastly higher than what they got for the sale of it a few months back, is it not? And certainly what we paid for that oil in the first place when we were filling up the
oil. Well, as much as I hate to admit it, Frank, I think they sold the oil for more than they're buying it back. And I can't believe they made a successful trade, but they did by mistake. Oil's about $70 a barrel now. And I think when they sold it, it was close to 100. So they can claim...
Some improvement, but certainly less... It was much less when we bought it originally. So
it's not going to cover our $1 trillion deficit this year.
That's for sure. And that is yawning before us and the source of much discussion in Washington at the moment. Bill, we have to leave it at that. I thank you, as always, for your insight into all of these issues of economic warfare against our country and the stakes involved.
One more thing, Frank. Buy the indictment. It's a terrific book. It's the best. I'm telling anybody watching. It's a terrific summary of what's at stake in China and what to do about it. So,
Bill, thank you very much for that. I hate to cut you off, but we have to go. And we'll see you next week, and we'll see the rest of you again tomorrow. Till then, go forth and multiply.